when it comes to women's in housing?
Well, unfortunately, I've seen things like I could not have anticipated 31 years ago how bad the housing crisis would be today. So while certainly there have been things that have improved for women in the 31 years that I've been doing this work, there are a lot of things that are worse than they were 31 years ago. Housing prices, wages, all of those things have deteriorated over the last 31 years. And so instead of, you know, what has gotten better, tragically, things have actually gotten worse when it comes to housing for everyone, and that, of course, disproportionately negatively affects women and kids.
Mm-hmm. But what has improved so far?
I see the problem here. It's worse. When it comes to housing, which is what the Pan-Canadian Voice for Women's Housing is about, things have actually deteriorated. And that's it's deteriorated for everybody. There's a, you know, there's no surprise to anybody. There's a housing crisis in this country, or there's a housing crisis and there's an income crisis. Like some people might argue it's not actually housing, it's income. It's income inequality, right? But yeah, it's definitely gotten worse.
Yeah, that's very sad to hear. But
and, you know, the other thing we can say too is, you know, and there's lots of folks that believe there's a connection between this data and the pandemic, but in fact, there's been more women murdered by their partners in the last couple of years than in recent history.
I heard that too. Yeah. That femicide is getting worse and worse every year, and so yeah, I would come to the end, almost the end here. Why are so many women, children, and gender diverse people turned away by shelters, and how can we prevent that?
So the short answer is it's because there's not enough shelters or not enough shelter beds. The longer answer is that you know, should we be exploring whether shelter beds are the best use of funding? Would it be better to build long-term housing? Shelter beds are short-term. They certainly work when women are in crisis, but they also create anxiety because they're short-term. And right now, women don't know where they're going to go after the shelter stay runs out. So I think that, you know, the easy answer, that sort of easiest answer is, well, we need to build more shelter beds, but then the question becomes, what's the best use of the limited funding? And should we be spending more money on shelters, or should we be spending more money on building long-term permanent housing so that women have housing options and don't have to go to shelters in the first place? Because there's definitely women who stay in violent abusive relationships because they have nowhere to go.
We are almost at the end of this interview, so do you have anything to add that I have missed asking about, or that would you like to add?
I don't think so. I think you had a pretty comprehensive list of questions there, and you gave me lots of leeway, so I can't think of anything I've missed.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dennis, for this interview. And I have one last question. Do you have a song that inspires you, gives you power?
Trying to probably people you've never heard of, like Tracy. I can't remember this Fast Car. So that might be one, or God, I need more time.
It's
Give me
a
time.
Tricky question. Yeah, you can.
Can I email you
a
few ideas?
Yeah, for sure. No worries, no stress. Yeah, thank you so much, Dennis, for this interview. And we are out here.
What is your opinion about paper book and electronic books?
Hi, my name is AJ. Paper books are more authentic, I guess, and electronic books are easy to carry, so if you're like a bookworm, it's easy to just keep up with all the book trends and everything. But I'm more like a visual person, I like to like, or like a hands-on person, so I like to have the book itself to be able to concentrate on everything. But yeah, the online book is not really for me. Even though it's good for textbooks, they're cheaper.
My name is Joshua. I think electronic books are more accessible nowadays, especially with how technology has grown. So I feel like they've become more popular in recent years compared to physical books. I would say at the start of COVID, I would say paper books. But as we transition through online, I would say ebooks now. I think it's just the convenience of having it on my screen while I'm doing my work. So it's a lot easier, yeah.
Hi, I'm Shivka. I'm a fourth year here at SFU. Ooh, I love a good paper book, but I do find myself using more ebooks recently just because it's more convenient and easy to read on the go. Like when you're on the bus, you don't have a whole thick book with you, just having your iPad and scrolling through, that's so much easier. But like the smell of the paper, if you know what I mean, from a real book, that's something I truly enjoy.
And the feeling of the writing is totally different from...
Yes, I feel much more connected to a book when I have it like physically in my hand as opposed to it just being like on my iPad. So yeah, it differs with papers too. Like when you're reading them for class, I read a lot because I'm in health sciences. And if I'm reading the actual paper in my hand, I'm like much more likely to remember it than just that on my iPad. So it's definitely different.
What is your opinion about paper book and electronic books?
My name's Sakaraj Garcha. I've only used online textbooks so far. This is my first semester, and I would say they're a lot easier, at least like in grade 12 when I'd have to be flipping through pages to find stuff. With e-textbooks, I can just hit Command F and like find the spot I'm looking for. So it's a lot more convenient.
How about paper book?
I feel like it's a lot more work and you have to carry them around, things like that. I'm not really a fan of them.
My name is Imani. I personally like electronic books a lot more. I would say just because I use all my technology, so I can bring my textbooks everywhere and not have like the heavy weight in my bag. I like paper books because I can write in them and I just like the feeling of them, but they are heavy and also more expensive usually. So I do kind of miss the paper writing, so I got a paper screen protector for my iPad, so then it kind of feels like paper, but I do really like the paper writing, which is kind of something I miss about the electronic books, I think.
This is Bird Note. When winter turns the world white, some animals of the northern latitudes follow suit. Call it a seasonal change of camouflage. Best known is the ermine, a small weasel whose fur changes from brown to snow white in winter. A few birds also change color. One such is the willow ptarmigan, a chicken-sized bird of the northern tundra known for its giddy voice. The willow ptarmigan, feathered mostly brown in summer, is utterly transfigured by an autumn molt. As snow begins to mantle its world, the newly white-feathered ptarmigan blends in superbly. Where a covey of ptarmigans sit with feathers fluffed up against the cold, they resembled nothing so much as a row of oversized snowballs. Only a flick of their black tail feathers gives them away. The ptarmigan pulls yet another winter trick. It adds dense feathering, white of course, on both the tops and bottoms of its feet, and its claws grow longer. The winter ptarmigan actually quadruples the bearing surface of its feet, which is to say, the bird grows snowshoes. Well, it's no wonder why the ptarmigan likes a good laugh. Take a good look at the chameleon bird, the ptarmigan, on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Joining me today is Richard Lee, counselor for the City of Burnaby, and Lisa Codd, who's part of Burnaby staff. And we're here to talk about a project the city is undertaking to issue an apology to its Chinese Canadian community over past policies and laws that the city of Burnaby enacted in the past century that were quite discriminatory. Perhaps we can start up. You can tell me what was the genesis of this project and why now?
All right. Thank you for the opportunity to answer that question. The city for quite a number of years now, starting mainly around 2017, has been actively researching Chinese Canadian history in Burnaby and sharing that information with the public. And part of that research surfaced past discriminatory policies and practices of our local government in Burnaby. And as a result, a community group, the Burnaby Intercultural Planning Table, in cooperation with the Coalition Against Racism, contacted our municipal council and suggested that we undertake a process like this. Council was very supportive of that suggestion, and so we're proceeding.
Right. So the whole project is about more than just an apology. There's an effort to do research and compile the history of these policies and but also to engage the community in the discussion. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I think it's important when you're apologizing to someone that you are also connecting to ensure that that apology is meaningful and that actions are taken in support of the apology. Similar apology processes at the City of Vancouver and New Westminster as well have included community engagement work to consult with the community, raise awareness of the issues, and also to identify legacy actions such as commemoration project that can support ongoing engagement with the community.
So what kind of policies, what kind of things have been discovered through this process? I've heard about some of them and they're kind of eye-opening in some cases.
Yeah, and there's still research to do. I think we're in our preliminary stage with our research, but there's a number of ways that as a local government, Burnaby discriminated against people of Asian descent. So some of those included joining advocacy efforts of other municipalities to try to exclude Asian immigration, for example. And some of those other actions targeted Chinese businesses. So bylaws that restricted trade licenses for greengrocers and piggery operators, which were a couple of the common businesses that Chinese Canadians had in the early part of the 20th century. And we also are the fourth bylaw. So this was a priority of Burnaby's early municipal council. The fourth bylaw enacted by Burnaby restricted employment of Asian Canadians by the local government or by anyone contracting services to the local government. And that bylaw remained in effect until 1953.
Yeah, I read another story about a bylaw that was proposed by a Vancouver-based chapter of the KKK and then adopted, well, maybe not a bylaw, but a policy adopted by Burnaby and I presume other municipalities in the area.
Yeah, so sometimes groups like the KKK advocated for discriminatory policies, and they would write to various levels of government and ask them to endorse their efforts. And yeah, our council did endorse those efforts. If I'm remembering them right, that was an effort to exclude Asian immigration.
It's interesting because we've heard a lot over the number of years about the policies put forth at the national and the provincial level. It's really interesting to see these similar things having happened at the municipal level. I guess in many ways, it's not really surprising, but it really is interesting to see what was going on. And I think one of the things about municipal governments that they have, in many cases, so many more points of contact with their citizens on even a daily basis that these kind of policies put in at the municipal level can be in many ways more impactful.
Yeah, and I'm sure that Councillor Lee could definitely speak to sort of the layers of discrimination by all levels of government that took place in the past.
Yeah. Thank you. As you know, and many people know that the federal government actually had the Chinese Exclusion Act at that level. So from early, probably 1885 1923, the Hack Tax was imposed to the Chinese community at that time. And actually, my grandfather paid for the HEC tax in 1913 to get into Canada as a farmer. So at that time, the HEC tax was imposed starting from $50 and increasingly quickly increased to 100 and then go up to went up to $500. I heard that at that time $500 you can buy two building lots in Chinatown, Vancouver.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of money to pay back. So I think over the years this kind of discriminatory policy had been redressed in the federal level in the 2007, and then provincially, we also did a recognition 2013-14 in that period, so that those discriminatory laws in the province level, well, we take out quite a few of those injustice law in the legislature in DC, and then redress that. We also just heard that Vancouver, of course, had redressed that, and New West did that as well. So I think this is a time between Vancouver and New West, Burnaby. We actually are going to do something on that front. So I'm very pleased to hear that. This is one page of a dark history in Canadian history. We would like to see what kind of laws and bylaws in the city level that had been passed or implemented. So I think this is a good way. As 100 years of the Chinese Exclusion Act, because after 1923, the city, the whole country actually implemented that federal law to ban actually immigration for the ordinary Chinese to come to Canada. So 1923 until 1947, after the Second World War, that because of the Chinese veterans, their contribution to defending Canada's value, as well as went to the war for Canada, that the Canadian government actually saying that now you can vote, you can have Canadian citizenship, that kind of thing. So I think for 100 years, I think this is a day that we should commemorate and see that those discriminatory laws won't see their lights again in the future.
So, I mean, what does it feel like to you personally as a member of the Chinese community to learn about these kind of policies enacted by the city you now represent on council?
Yeah, the KKK resolution passed by the council, endorsement by the council at that time. That was the first, I mean, I just heard about that a few months ago. So those are new to me. And I think some of those histories we need to learn more as a community to see what kind of actually bylaws will pass as a city. So I think it would be interesting that our next generation will learn about the history and also the community itself. We see that now we are really fortunate to live in a harmonious society. We should treasure our position, our daily life, and also the rights and freedom in this good Canadian society.
Have you heard from members of the community in response to this initiative?
From the newspaper, the Chinese Canadian newspaper. They also publish news about this initiative from Burnaby. They are very supportive. I believe also there are some people would like to be sitting in the committee as well to see how they can contribute to this process. We learned that Burnaby also will be publishing a book about Chinese Canadians in the city, and the community is really positive on seeing the result of that book, the contents, etc. So I think thanks to the city staff and the council, and they look into this issue and very supportive of these initiatives.
In many ways, all these bylaws and policies and regulations enacted by the city and the other level governments must have really only been, in many ways, the tip of the iceberg, because when all the levels of government are putting in these kinds of policies and whatnot, that must really have emboldened individuals and even people working for the city to express and act on their racist attitudes. You mentioned it, a dark period in history. It spreads out and becomes bigger than just a matter of policy and bylaw. So what's the timeline for the completion of the project?
We'll be going out to consult with the community in the fall and also in 2024, and we're expecting the formal apology in 2025. It's important to take the time to do the consultation and that engagement with the community. And some of this information is a surprise to members of the community. So I think we need to take the time to be able to get the word out about what happened and what is happening.
When it is offered, what will the apology look like? Will there be a public ceremony, or has that been determined yet?
That is something we'll work with the community on. I think every community will have its own desire of what they want that apology to look like in terms of the level of formality, the languages that it needs to be delivered in, the place where it might be delivered in. So there's still a lot that we want to work out, but we want to make sure that we're engaging with the community to make those decisions.
And will there be any lasting legacy or a public display or memorial?
So that also is something that will come out of the consultation to find out what those legacy projects might look like. Although, the city, as Councillor Lee mentioned, has taken on a number of projects to commemorate Chinese Canadian history in Burnaby, including a book that will be published later this year. And I think it's just important to remember that though we're talking about this incredible web of racism and discriminatory policies from all levels of government, including several local governments, there's also these stories of incredible resilience of the Chinese Canadian community members. So we want to make sure we're also telling those stories of resilience and the way that community members contributed. And in Burnaby, a lot of that contribution was growing food. Chinese Canadian farmers grew, despite restrictions on land ownership, were able to farm an incredible amount of food that fed the region. Actually, Councillor Lee's family was a farm family as well.
Yeah, actually, the Leung's family, they still operate in the South Burnaby. The Leung's family, they had a market garden in the Musqueam land, reserve land, near Dunbar and Marine Drive. My grandfather actually farmed in that Musqueam reserve land for almost 30 years as a partner in a market garden, and so they leased the land from the First Nations and with a partner. And one time they are over, I think, 20 market gardeners in that area. So I heard many stories about the market gardeners. Larry Grant, senior elder in that community, told me a lot of stories, and including he was playing in the Hong Kong Garden, the Market Garden, and then that's our interaction with my grandfather. So I think that's some of the stories mm-hmm. to tell. Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me today. I think this is a really important project, and as we've seen from what has come forth so far, there's a lot of stuff that people did not know about, and it's important to shine a light on those things, and it's really great to see Burnaby doing this. Thank you for joining me today, Lisa Codd, with the City of Vancouver, and Richard Lee, Councillor, with the City of Burnaby.
All right. Thank
Lisa
you.
Codd, and Richard Lee, Councillor with the City of Burnaby, both with the City of Burnaby. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, pleasure talking to you.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you the best for the new year.